All right. Okay, everybody, let's do our prayer detail. In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. St. Michael, the Archangel, defend us in battle. Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. We humbly pray to the Prince of the Heavenly Host, through the power of God, cast into hell Satan and all his evil spirits, who prowl about the world seeking the ruin of souls. Amen. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Okay, today what we're going to do is talk about the prisoner of war experience. And to lead this off, I'd like to cite from the second book, actually. This is called A Prisoner's Duty, Great Escapes in U.S. Military History. And that in the beginning of chapter one, which I call the dominance of will, and it says, for the most part, captives, hostages, and prisoners provide footnotes to the military experience rather than a central focus. Wars over religion, territory, mercantile interests, colonies, or even ideologies were too serious to devote much time worrying about prisoners of war. Captured soldiers were, after all, public enemies and burdens to their captors and living symbols of lost battles to those at home. Prisoners were never really considered heroes except to themselves because wars were won and lost in spite of them and not because of them. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I brought in the three books that I've written on prisoners of war. The first one was published in 1994 with the University Press of Kansas in their Modern War series. It's a bit too long, but the fellow said that, out of Kansas, said he wanted to get me in print as soon as possible. The chapter 10 of this book was called, well, what was about escapers, chapter 10 of this book became A Prisoner's Duty, Great Escapes in Military History. And that at the very end of this book, I asked my readers, I said, what happened, you know, how did we treat them? You know, were we, you know, always, you know, the good guys? Were we always, did we always obey the law? Were we always humane to the people that we took into captivity during wartime? And so the answer is, yeah, for the most part, not all the time. And not all the time meant really the Civil War. And so where we're going in our class in Civil War and where we're going, you know, in terms of the films we're going to see have a great deal to do with the prisoner of war experience of the Civil War. Of all the wars that we fought, I think, the Civil War was perhaps the worst. Not because people intended to murder other people as prisoners. No. That intention was never there, not on either side, not on the Confederate side or the Union side. Intention. But did it happen? Yes. Over 20,000 Union men died in Confederate prisons, and over 22,000 or so Confederates died in Yankee prisons. What did they die of? Disease. More than anything else. War wounds. When they were initially captured, you didn't recover, excuse me, easily from war wounds. And that you know that medicine was a real horror show during the Civil War. So between war wounds, and then there was this lack of a perception vitamins and, you know, what in terms of nutrition science didn't exist. And so what they were feeding these guys was really bad. And this was on both sides. And so the men, their immune systems really weakened and weakened very badly. I'm amazed when I read Civil War materials that anyone survived some of these places at all. And that's what so amazed me. And even escaped, that also amazed me. the guy's digging tunnels like Barry Benson out of Elmira and 110 Union officers out of Libby. Anyhow, so I asked in the second book, I said, what did we do to them? And that is, to me, was a primary consideration. And where did I start that? I started with the Revolutionary War. But, people were captives long before the Revolutionary War was ever thought of. But they weren't. Some of them became captives of the French during the French and Indian War. The French, of course, if you were a good Puritan, would try to convert you. In fact, the French were buying captives taken by Indians from Englishmen who were good, solid Puritans. And the French believed that they were so pious in their Puritan faith, all we needed to do was show them the true faith and they would convert them. And lo and behold, that happened from time to time. And one of the leading members of the Ursuline orders had been a Puritan woman who was sold by the Indians to the French and then converted and then became a nun and remained in Canada for the rest of her life. She would make trips down to New England to visit her family. Then she had to take off her nun's habit, put on civilian clothes, because the Massachusetts Puritans wouldn't let any nuns in. Times were tough all over, you know. And so, there are some riveting stories of Indian captivities. Really, my favorite one, if I can find it quickly, which I probably can't, is about, don't worry about it, Hannah Dustin, who was captured at this time. Actually, I think Hannah was captured during the King Philip's War, a nasty New England world war. Instead of being dominated by her captors, she, after these Indians had killed her baby, and wiped out her family, the nurse went with her, and after several removes, this is sort of on a long march, and in the middle of the night, she picked up a tomahawk and killed all her captors, and she whacked them on the head. And then she scalped them, and she took the scalps back to the governor of Massachusetts and cashed in because they were paying a bounty. This was Hannah Dustin, and her story is remembered, some of the annals of in New England. In the modern historical climate, that's not quite PC enough for them. They do prefer people like Mary Jameson, who remained with the Indians for most of her life during the American Revolution. But, you know, we're historians. We're not English majors here, so that's correct. So we try to chase this stuff down. There were hundreds and hundreds of these captivities throughout these colonial wars. But in this book, I started with the Revolution. And I had to get into George Washington. The more I read George Washington's letters, and I spent an entire summer doing this, ask Kathy Donahue down to the library, I found that George Washington was one of the most remarkable military figures I've ever came in contact with. It's just remarkable. And he had an army of scribes who would copy letters. So he would say to one of his secretaries, now, I want you to create this letter and take dictation or something of that effect. And this guy would write it up, and then he would sign it, and then it would go around to his army of scribes because it would go out to everybody. He had an amazing sense of organization. But he had an amazing sense, too, of the humanity that was part of the era, as well as the violence of warfare. And so he was constantly writing letters to the British general in charge, whether it was Gage or whether it was Clinton or any of these, the men who were in charge of the British, begging them for humane treatment of the Americans held by, in their charge. And he promised them, to the best of his ability, that he would return this humanity and treat the British in his charge as well as possible. Well, the big question is, did he do that? And the answer is, to the best of his ability. There were some unusual circumstances in the Revolution where a great number of prisoners fell into American hands after certain battles. The first big one was in was at the Battle of Trenton. And that was, what, Christmas Eve of 1776, I think. They weren't British. They defeated the Hessians, the Germans, who were working for the British. Captured about 800 of them. Excuse me. What do you do with 800 prisoners? There was no such thing as a prison camp. What do you do with these guys? Well, if you saw Pennsylvania at that time, three-quarters of Pennsylvania was German-speaking. So what we're going to do is take all these Germans and send them out with other Germans and see if you can possibly do something with them. Nobody knew for sure what they were going to do with the Germans. But one thing he did do, right after the Battle of Trenton, after he took all these German prisoners of war, a few of the officers asked, he had them to dinner, for starters. These are the good old days. He had them, the senior officers, to dinner, and they were amazed at his, congeniality and how cordial he was. They were not used to this, being treated this way. And three of the lieutenants, or junior officers, told Washington at the dinner that they had to leave Trenton so quickly that they left all their personal belongings there. And so he sent them under guard to go get their clothes the next day. And they got all their stuff. In this book, I have a print of the Germans being marched into Philadelphia. I was amazed at being, this is it. I don't know if you can see it real well. These were all German soldiers, Hessians, who weren't from Hesse, most of them, being marched through Philadelphia. And it does say in German, basically, the Hessians from General Washington, 25 December 1776, captured at Trenton, are brought through Philadelphia, or marched through Philadelphia. And that didn't have their weapons because the Americans had the weapons. So they dispersed them out in the German-speaking area of Pennsylvania. The next big capture, excuse me, for the Americans was at the Battle of Saratoga in 1777. This is New York State, and not just to the north of Albany. And the British were attempting to cut the colonies in half and to attack Albany from the north, from Canada. It was a bit of a long walk, and that they took a lot, too much time, and they got tangled up in the woods. And the Americans, Benedict Arnold was there too, as well as some other very famous Americans. Anyway, it was commanded by General Gates, and he was an older man, very much probably the most British of all the American generals. And Gates, with the assistance of some very, very good colonels, actually managed to surround the British and bombard them, forcing the British to surrender. And then after the surrender, guess what Gates did? He had all the Brits and the Germans for dinner. And that the wife of the German commanding officer, her name was Madame von Riedesel. The Brits could never pronounce Riedesel. They called her Red Hazel. Writes a stunning narrative of how shocked she was at the cordial behavior of all these guys who were trying to kill each other the day before. Well, Gates makes a deal with the Brits. It was about several thousand of them, maybe 3,000, 4,000 captures. He makes a deal with them. He says, look, we will treat you very well. We will disarm you. and we will send you back to Britain as fast as we can. And this was known as the convention. Well, I mean, it was perhaps the finest, the most lenient surrender ever done on the American continent. And lo and behold, what happened then? Congress rejected it. Yes. Congress said, he can't make a deal like that. We are, in fact, in charge here, not this General Gates. And we will decide what happens to these 3,000 Brits and Hessians and members of Parliament and all the rest of it. And so they marched them from Saratoga. They kept these guys until 1783. They went home when the surrenders from Yorktown went home. Now, did they keep them in stockades, barracks? Yes. There were barracks all over Pennsylvania. One of the strangest stories about this period was, again, about the Hessians. There were Hessians in this group, too. First we had the Trenton Hessians. Now we have the Saratoga Hessians. So Congress, in its brilliance, decided this sort of the same thing as Washington had back in Trenton. Well, the Germans, we'll put the Germans with the Germans. Now, Reading, Pennsylvania was a German-speaking community. Have any of you ever been to Reading? Okay, yeah, right. Mr. Derenkamp over here. I met his German cousins in Germany, I think. They're all big like him. Oh, yeah, that's a Westphalian name. It really is. Anyhow, so they sent these Germans to Reading, Pennsylvania. And the Germans in Reading were mostly Lutherans, not Mennonites, mostly Lutherans. And here come these guys in blue and green, and they were aghast, absolutely aghast. Oh, my God, what are you doing here? You're the reason we left Germany. And they completely rejected these guys. The next big capture in the Revolution was Yorktown. There's some other, lots of skirmishes and whatnot. But the next really big one was the Battle of Yorktown. And this is the place where it's in Virginia. It's along the James River. And this was the final big surrender of the British to the Americans. And this time Washington was there for this one, as he was for Trenton. The entire British Army surrendered. They tried to negotiate a surrender that would send them back to England very quickly. Washington didn't want to hear that. Washington was the first guy to issue. Remember, we talked about Grant and what do we call him? Unconditional surrender Grant, right? Well, Washington was unconditional surrender Washington before Grant, but he did give good terms. To the British. The British behaved like babies when it came, giving up their bottles or something, when they surrendered, throwing their guns down and just made complete you-know-whats of themselves. But we still got them, and we bagged them. And they stayed till 1783 as well, from 1781 to 1783. We would send the officers back early under paroles. That particular officer, who was General Lord Cornwallis, really became the viceroy in India when the Brits conquered India just thereafter. The Brits were in a world war, and we were only one little part of it. And although we won our part of it, they won their other part of it, and that increased their kingdom. The Brits, however, were not good captors for us. Some historians say that they disagree on the numbers a lot. Big captures for the Americans, it was first Fort Washington up in New York City, all these various battles, they're going to take, prisoners here, prisoners there. Never really, except for Charleston in 1780, we lost the battle there to the Brits, and they locked our men up in these prison hulks, And, you know, relatively few people survived these prison hulks. The vast majority of them. Anybody here from New York State, New York? No? Okay. You know where the Washington, where the Brooklyn Navy Yard is, or was? Okay. That area contained something about, something like 40 old British ships that were good for nothing else. And they parked them in there, and they put prisoners on them, Americans. And the stories they tell are just absolutely horrendous. They liked the Hessian guards because the Hessians were decent to them. But the British put just the scum of the earth as guards for these guys. And thousands upon thousands of people died in ships like the Jersey. And there were a lot of them aboard here we go. Let's see if I can find it. That's World War I. That's before World War I. Here we go. The British ships in America that contained prisoners, prison hulks, the John, the Good Intent, that's a funny name, the Glasgow, the Frederick, the Cheatham, hulks, the Whitby, the Prince of Wales, the Good Hope, the Kitty, the Felicity, the Jersey, the Preston, the Grosvenor, the Judith, the Woodland, the Myrtle, the Lord, Falmouth, Scheldt, Clyde, Scorpion, which was a particularly nasty one, Dunlace, and then there was hospital ships. They weren't hospital ships. These were places they took them to die. The Hunter, the Perseverance, and the Bristol Packet. There were also prison hulks in Charleston Harbor, one called the Torbay, one called the Packhorse. And they even had a prison hulk down in San Lucia in the West Indies. Can you imagine? There's no air conditioning in these things. And these men really and truly suffered badly. There we go. When sailors were captured at sea fighting the British, they would take them to England. And they put them in these large facilities. Mill Prison was one of the most popular ones. And Falmouth Prison was another one. And curiously enough, the Americans were escaping like bunnies. Because, you know, there's a poet in France by the name of Benjamin Franklin. And Ben Franklin had a lot of friends in England. And he also, made a lot of contacts with a lot of preachers, really, who were often on the side of the Americans, quietly. And so deals were made so that people could get out of Mill Prison and Fortin Prison and Falmouth Prison and sort of were taken into the sort of a British underground. In World War II, they call these things escape lines. But he was doing this. And he got one very famous Pennsylvanian out. It was said because he thought his wife was very nice, and the wife was, Ben was a guy who liked an ankle or two, and so, you know, I'm just being very generous to Ben. I know. Don't read too much, Franklin. You'll get bad ideas. Anyway, but his name was, Gustavus, what? I have to look at it myself. It's been a while since I messed with this. Anyway, so he actually put him into an escape line, got him out, sent him back to Pennsylvania, and he rejoined the Pennsylvania Navy. Amazing. John Paul Jones worked for Ben Franklin. John Paul Jones was really a privateer. All the guys that sailed with John Paul Jones were French. It was only a handful of guys on the Bonhomme Richard who were not French. Oh, yes. But John Paul Jones had a tough, he was a tough disciplinarian. He was never captured. Well, his first officer was Nathaniel Fanning. He was captured and became a prisoner of the British. They did not exchange Americans. You see, because the Americans during the Revolutionary War were all, not all privateers, but even, remember, you know, who were the Pennsylvania Navy or the New Jersey Navy or the Continental Navy. These guys were considered pirates by the British and traitors if they were soldiers. And the British felt no obligation whatsoever to extend to them the courtesies of being a prisoner of war. You're a rebel. There are no rules. You're outside the four corners of the legal fabric. You know, you're out there in Never Never Land. We can do anything we want to you. And they did. In the prison hulks, it was estimated, this is in New York and in Charleston, it's estimated we lost about 18,000 men. We lost more men as prisoners than we did on the field of battle in the American Revolution. And why'd they die? It's not because they were executed by the British, though they did some of that. They died because they were poorly fed, and your immune system goes down a drain. You're on these prison hulks, and it's the end of time for you. Okay. That was the, you know, so the Revolutionary War left really a bad taste in the mouth of the Americans. The British, they said, The British don't call it the Revolutionary War. You know what the British call that? They call it the American War of Independence. And they're sort of embarrassed because they sort of lost us, but they kept Canada, and they want to keep Canada, and we badly wanted Canada anyway. We're going to try to get Canada on several occasions. And then, but they got India, they beat up the French, that wonderful little fleet that came up, De Grasse's fleet, who came up and blocked the British from getting out of Yorktown. That went to the bottom in less than a year after all of that. Maybe it was more than a year. The British caught up to him down in the Caribbean. That was it for him. That was De Grasse and him, gone. Nice fleet. The French built nice ships, but they didn't fight them very well. Yeah. British, much better gunners and a far more aggressive. And the French were on sort of, you know, in defense. And at sea, it doesn't work. Anyhow, so the French are not going to do very well. But as we roll into the 19th century, the Americans had this terrible experience with several North African countries. It is not in our active memory these days. They were called the Barbary Powers along the Barbary coast. It was Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, and what was known as Tripoli. And that this is where the Marine Corps was born, really, as a permanent force during these wars. And it was Thomas Jefferson, really, who authorized the beginning of the U.S., the real Navy, permanent Navy, and a permanent Marine Corps. And so it was the Navy and the Marine Corps who were going to rescue American sailors who had been taken by the Barbary, and we always call them Barbary pirates. The whole reason for this thing is sort of odd. Before the Revolution, we had our merchant marine was literally all over the world. We were sitting in China, and all over the Mediterranean. But we flew the British flag. And the British always paid these people off. It was called making peace with money. That's how they did it. We call it, you know, so we have other names for that, and none of which tribute, not a nice word. Now, there's something that just turns our stomach on that, you know. So anyway, we got tangled up with these people because they stole our people. And they put them in these jails called bagnios. And that it really depended what country you were in, under whose direction. And they were pretty miserable folks. They wanted to convert them, and some did convert. Not many, and none of the U.S. Navy guys. And that the doctor aboard the USS Philadelphia, which had run aground in Algiers Harbor, they took all these guys captive and treated them very badly. So what they did was they sent, after they built a Navy, a pretty decent ships, frigates now, sent them over to Algeria to convince the Algerians that this has got to be done. This is over. Well, they got to Morocco first, and they sat down with the King of Morocco and made a peace deal with him. This was basically, you've all seen The Godfather. And it was basically your brains or your signature on the contract. And that's how they did business with these people. So Morocco was the first one. That peace treaty still holds today. We've never had to sign another peace treaty with Morocco. Yeah. And then there was Tunisia. Then same thing they did there. Anybody who was held captive, they got him out. The last to go was Algiers. And so I firmly believe that the SEAL team was born in Algiers in 1805 or so, and that the squadron sent one ship with a fellow by the name of Stephen Decatur Jr. And his men, some of whom became heroes of the 1812 war, into the harbor. They took out the guards aboard the Philadelphia. Philadelphia was run so hard aground, she couldn't get off. Nothing. I mean, tides wouldn't take it off. This thing was in the mud, and that was it. But this was a major, major ship of the line for the Americans. I mean, this was one of the largest ships we had, and something had to be done. So with Navy guys, what do you do with a ship like that? You blow it up. And so they sent Decatur and his guys in there, and they crept in, took out the guards silently, planted charges all over the ship, got off, got back to their own ship, and blew the hell out of that thing. There wasn't any splinters left. And then they went to the Dey of Algiers and convinced them to sign on the dotted line. Now, they did have the Marine Corps doing a sweep and come in the city from the other end. So they got them on both ends. It was a pincer movement. And that, so the Marines remember this. They remember from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Well, this is the shores of Tripoli time. And so, yeah. So we freed our captives. And we made peace with these people and refused to pay any more tribute. Because the Washington administration was paying tribute to these four Barbary powers. It cost us a lot of money. It's cheaper to build the ships. It's what that turned out to be. So after this is over, then we have, we're fighting Indians in early on, the Seminoles and whatnot. There's not a whole lot of captivity stuff going on with them. Although there's a very famous story of Osceola, who was captured and put into what turned out to be Fort Marion in St. Augustine. Augustine, rather, and he died in captivity, apparently, and Indians did not do well in captivity. But I have a whole chapter in the third book about Indians in captivity, and it's amazing that they were able to survive. By the 19th century, times were changing. Okay, now after this little foray, we're going to run into the War of 1812. Never was there a more complicated affair. And that there we go. Hey, I got it the first time. Oh, yeah. Oh, well, never mind the Quakers. We always call it the Second American Revolution. And that James Madison wrote, to secure a significant number of hostages, to answer in their persons for the proper treatment of certain number of American officers now in possession of the enemy. So things are going to start changing in terms of how they treated each other. When the revolution ended in 1783, Americans believed the rest of the world would leave them alone. Issues such as banking and financial management of the American government commanded center stage. Foreign trade, and diplomacy fell a long way down the ladder of priorities. It was always called James Madison's War. The Southerners hated the war because it cost them a lot of money. The Northerners were basically all for it at first and then turned against it as well. This was not a popular war in the United States. And that, but lo and behold, the United States came up with a magnificent set of ships, Constitution. And when the Constitution engaged the frigate Guerriere in battle, it was the first time that a major in a navy was defeated by a minor one. We fought on Lake Erie, and we built our own ships there. Poor William Henry Harrison lost 900 Americans to the British in the and Indians at the Battle of the River Raisin. Again, the Indians massacred all the prisoners. Not good. And that, don't worry, we'll get even with them. But we fought on Lake Champlain, won there. Three battles changed the landscape of 1812. Horseshoe Bend was fought in Alabama on 27 March of 14, when then Major General Andrew Jackson and his Tennessee volunteers attacked and defeated the Creeks, who were then allied with the British. Jackson was a furious fighter. He took no prisoners and killed all 800 Indians. So he established his presence at Horseshoe Bend, indeed, and impressed the Indians. The British were infuriated at these upstart American enemies, and so they decided that something had to be done which made an impression. So they bombarded Fort McHenry in Baltimore, from which we get our Star-Spangled Banner. And they're also going to plan to sail to the Gulf of Mexico. Now, you all know about the battle in New Orleans, no problem. But the prisoner scene was very different. The War of 1812, as was the case in the Revolution, each country supplies its own prisoners in enemy hands. And you had a commissary of prisoners, a commissariat, and a commissar, basically, commissioner, of prisoners. And his job was to feed, clothe, and pay American prisoners in British hands. Were they successful? Not all the time. But the British had the same thing. There was a British guy in charge of doing the same thing for those Brits who were held by the Americans. We kept the British in all kinds of places during in 1812. Prison camps? Nah, not so much. Jails are good. County jails, they were down in, you know, as low as the local county lockup, and they would keep them in there. And they would. And I saw documents from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania talking about how the commissioner is going to feed General so-and-so, who's in the such-and-such county jail in the middle of Pennsylvania. And, of course, the general writing using microfilm is the only way he could do it. It drove my eyes crazy. And that just reading all the letters of complaints. The British are good at complaining. Oh, we're not bad either, but anyway, beginning in 1812, the American and British representatives met in Halifax, Nova Scotia, to establish a cartel. Now, a cartel, not, you know, we use the cartel in some other courses to talk about, you know, things that were going on in the late 19th century with business. This is a different kind of thing. What this is an agreement between two countries to swap prisoners. But it's really strange in the way they did it. Like, one general would be worth maybe three colonels. One colonel might be worth three majors, or two majors and five captains and, you know, six lieutenants, that kind of thing. And they would work out all of these various combinations, and so this, they actually pull this off, and that the prisoners taken at sea or land on both sides shall be treated with humanity, conformable to the usage and practice of most civilized nations during the war. And such prisoners would be without delay, would be exchanged. So they would. So now the United States was not an illegal place, not an illegal country. These guys were, in fact, prisoners of war in the War of 1812, both sides. Were not criminals or pirates or any of the rest of it. And so they started, the treatment was much better. Very few prisoners died in captivity in the War of 1812. other than war wounds and the usual stuff. But and they were not kept that long. So what we have is a cartel being formed. Let's see. Let me see. Hello. Yeah, here's some interesting stuff about it. War costs the United States about $105 million. In Canada, after starting the war with just over 8,000 troops, the British raised the level to 25,975 by war's end. And according to General Althoff, had the war continued, the United States would have continued to fight. Commanders got better as they received on-the-job training in the art of war, and recruiting expanded as revenge filled the air for the burning of Washington. But we burned their capital first. That's something that we just don't remember. We actually went, it was called, their capital was called York. It's now, I think, called Toronto. And we burned it first. It was an accident. They blew up an armory, and the armory just got the town. But they got permanently mad at that. And so the Brits wanted to get even, and did. And that there was some serious urban renewal down there in what they called then Washington City. But the Barclay cartel that came out of this, I'll call the Barclay-Mason cartel, was really a masterpiece of an agreement for its time. And so as it turns out, very few people died in captivity in the War of 1812. And so that was a precedent. So first precedent we have was Washington wanting to be humane to the British soldiers in terms of the British promised to be humane to our people. And so this concept of humanity is the first precedent that we have to remember. Second thing, then we get to 1812, we have the idea of legitimacy of soldiering and the legal status of soldiering, and that countries are allowed to make deals with each other to guarantee not only treatment but exchange so that people can get back alive. The next war was really, in the world of weird wars, we're there, and that is the Mexican-American War. Now, the Texas War of Independence, I can't really discuss in terms of prisoners, because the Mexicans didn't take prisoners. They didn't take prisoners at the Alamo, and everybody was killed there, including David Crockett, Jim Bowie, and others. And about 400 Americans were executed by the Mexicans in a place called Goliad, another very nasty scene. There were some survivors of Goliad, though. Mostly the Mexicans would hide, some of the more senior, captains and majors, that's it, of Fannin's men. The Mexican people were just aghast at this. And this was all ordered by General Santa Anna, of course. And, even the Mexicans didn't want to do this at Goliad. But anyhow, so there wasn't much prisoner taking in Texas. And there was almost no prisoner taking at all during the Mexican-American War. Because you talk about going online and getting stuff, and we've been talking about that in here. I found the papers of General Zachary Taylor and Winfield Scott in there, and I found all their after-action reports. And they would, yes, and they would say, I'll give you a sample of it. Let me go find Mexico. I had fun with Mexico. It was really a remarkable thing. And that, let me see, here is, okay, hang on here. Be patient with me a minute. I'll find it. Oh, yeah, here we go. Winfield Scott. This is, where are we? Oh, yeah, even Robert E. Lee is there to further reconnoiter enemy positions. And so in charges and counterattacks, General Santa Anna believed he had won the day because of heavy losses, but the Americans kept coming and showed their skills in hand-to-hand fighting. The Mexicans broke their lines one after another, fell apart at the seams. This is at Veracruz, I think, Fat Mountain. Okay, Cerro Gordo. Broke their lines one after the other, fell apart at the seams, and believed there were many more American soldiers in the field than there actually were. There were 3,000 enemy prisoners of war taken by the American Army that day. And this is what Scott wrote. I have determined to parole the prisoners, officers and men, as I have not the means of feeding them here beyond today, and cannot afford to detach a body of horse and foot with wagons to accompany them to Veracruz. Our baggage train, though increasing, is not half large enough to give an assured progress to this army. Besides, a greater number of prisoners would possibly escape from the escort in the long and deep sandy road without subsistence, 10-1, than we should find again. Out of the same body of men in the ranks opposed to us, not one of the Veracruz prisoners is believed to have been in the lines of Cerro Gordo. Some six of the officers highest in rank refused to give their paroles except to go to Veracruz and then perhaps to the United States. So what they did was to parole them all, or as many as would take, would swear that they go home and not fight the Americans again. It was truly an amazing precedent. And very few people remember anything about it. Here are these two American generals, one after the other, Taylor first, old rough and ready, and then followed by Winfield Scott, old fuss and feathers, and both of them were pretty good generals. And they were faced with having thousands and thousands of Mexican prisoners, knowing full well that they had to take care of them. So what they did, and this was another huge precedent for the American treatment of prisoners. They literally made them sign a parole. I will go home. I will fight you no more until I'm properly exchanged. Well, they would never be properly exchanged, you see. That was impossible because there were a lot more Mexican prisoners than were taken by the Mexicans. There were a few taken by the Mexicans, just a handful, and they survived it. By and large, Mexicans during the Mexican-American War were not as brutal as they were during the Texas War. Of course, they were getting thumped, and that is a big difference. There were 10 battles in the Mexican War. The American Army lost none of them and took prisoners in every single battle. And in every instance, they were paroled and sent home. Now, the memory of this kind of thing, this parole and then send them home, did not go away. It didn't disappear into nothingness. But when the Civil War comes, it's a whole different story. This was the most misunderstood war. At the time, as I think we all have this notion now, it'll be over by Christmas. We're going to roll this thing right up, no problem. We're just going to go down, show those Rebs what to do, what we can do. The Rebs say, oh, come on there, bring it on there, pal. And so until U.S. Grant said this is going to be a war of conquest and a long one. And it was that. And that many of us saw Gettysburg on Sunday and watched that whole thing. You can see that was a major turning point for the Army in Northern Virginia. They could never recover from that very well. But the prisoner scene... And it's so complex. It really is. It seemed like the Americans learned nothing. That they had forgotten nearly everything about precedents from wars in the past. With that said, I'll come back to the Civil War. I want to go beyond that. The next one of any content is going to be the war with Spain. The war with Spain is going to take place in two parts. The first part is going to be in Cuba, where the Americans are going to fight a very good Spanish army, very well-trained, professional army. These guys were good, really good. This was not a ragtag bunch at all. Then the only reason they gave up is because their navy had deteriorated to a point where the navy could not support the army, and we took the navy out like that at the Battle of Santiago de Cuba. And their navy wasn't worth anything. I mean, they didn't have any new ships. It had deteriorated. I mean, they were just sitting ducks. And the American Navy was on the rise, and they were very aggressive. And so we sank the Spanish Navy, contained the Spaniards at Santiago, and the Spaniards gave up. Well, we got to the table with Spain and sort of sat down with them. They wanted to get out of the business of having colonies in the New World, and they had their last colony was Cuba, and now we're not going to give them Cuba. I mean, we didn't have Cuba to give them. Cuba belonged to the Cubans. But we did take Puerto Rico. Thank you very much. That was, you know, right of conquest. And we sat down at the table and said, what else you got? Well, we have Guam. We'll take it. And we have the Philippines. We'd be delighted to take it. But there's a problem. Well, the good news is we with the Spanish prisoners who surrendered to the Americans, they got the royal treatment. The officers, especially the Navy ones, were sent to Annapolis. They were living in the dorms, the midshipmen dorms, were basically hotel rooms for Spanish officers. They were permitted to go to mass downtown every day if they wanted to do, and some of them did. They had the free roam of the place. The people of Annapolis loved these guys. They were, you know, sort of, thought they were the cat's whiskers. And, the Admiral Cervera writes this wonderful letter to the people of Annapolis thanking them for their hospitality. The troops, however, were taken up to Portsmouth Naval Prison. Even that wasn't so bad. But they did have one small incident at sea when an American sailor guard aboard the USS Harvard was a transport sort of, and that was giving these guys an order. They didn't understand the English. They didn't obey the order. A few shots, a couple down, and then just spread these people out. And it was basically a misunderstanding rather than a refusal to obey orders. Okay? So that was the only nasty incident in the whole thing. And they went home very quickly. They weren't around very, very long. But Admiral Cervera and his staff had the run of the place of Annapolis. So we won that one. That was a good one. That was a good one. But we ran into problems in Cuba, in the Philippines, because the Filipinos had fought the Spaniards, and our reputation as liberators had preceded us. And that the president, who this is now about 1899, and so we still have McKinley, issued this presidential executive order called Benevolent Assimilation. Welcome to the land of freedom, our little brown brothers from the Philippines. Emilio Aquinaldo, who was basically the leader of these, and they call themselves insurrectos, which means in Spanish, insurrectionists, right? That's what they call themselves, insurrectos. And that was an honorable term. Well, they did not take to benevolent assimilation. They thought the Americans were coming to liberate them and to give them what they had been fighting the Spanish for, that is, their country. And that they did not appreciate that song title, You Belong to Me, very much. And so, but they also realized they couldn't fight the U.S. Army with the kind of weapons they had. They had Craig Jorgensen's then, and they had real guns, you know. And so what Aquinaldo did, this is the president, then president of the Philippines, broke them into guerrilla organizations. And so the Americans had to fight guerrilla warfare from 1902 to 1905. That did not work. Americans do not respond well to guerrilla warfare. They get angrier and angrier. And so what happened was there was an escalating war psychosis, and that on top of that, there was a lot of, I hate to even say it. The Americans were forbidden to use the water board. Now, this is where the water board was really used a lot, was in the Philippines, on prisoners to get them to talk. Well, the water board is, you know, is not throwing a towel over somebody's face. That's how they trained us in survival school. I went through this training. It's scary to get a big wet towel thrown in your face, can't breathe. That's not what they did over there. They would stick a hose down a guy's throat and then get the water going in, blowing his gut up about yay, and then they jump on him. And then they say, going to answer the next question. So it didn't take long for these guys to talk. That was the real water board. And that Americans were forbidden to do it by the commanding generals, forbidden to do this. Did some of them do it? Maybe. But the real problem in the Philippines was guys were writing home these god-awful letters saying that they were going on goo-goo hunts. Now, you can imagine what a goo-goo is. We always, for us, it was Charlie. For my dad, it was Japs or Krauts. But for the guys in the Philippines, the bad guys were goo-goos or worse. So they would write home these, you know, these letters saying, you know, saying how big and tough they were going out in goo-goo hunts, and we wouldn't let any captives live and all that. And it fed into the anti-war press. How much of this actually went on? Probably that much. How much did it get blown out of proportion? Probably that much. But there was a lot of disagreement. When these guys got home, the veterans wouldn't, the other veterans wouldn't talk to them. They really wouldn't talk to them. They wouldn't give the veterans of the government would not give the veterans of the Philippine operations even a campaign medal. Never existed. Now, that was unprecedented. That was unbelievable for the beginning of the 20th century. So the whole scene about prisoners, they didn't keep any prisoners of ours, generally. A few here and there, nothing really serious. World War One, we were only in it for a year. And World War One is unusual in many ways. The British came over and trained us in warfare that we had long forgotten, the kind of warfare that was fought at Petersburg. And that, anyway, they came over and tried to train the American army guys in how to fight trench warfare. And the Americans listened to them until they start talking about, oh, don't take Kraut prisoners, because they're all phony prisoners anyway. They're going to try to kill you. Well, the Americans didn't buy that. And General John Pershing writes in his memoirs, he says, it was everywhere noticeable that whether in prison or at work, the German soldier always retained his military bearing and his excellent discipline. We were not mad at the Germans in World War One. It was odd. So the British were, the French were, but we were not. And that they held a little over 4,000 of our prisoners, and we held, enormous numbers of theirs by the time it was over. And so what I write about the World War One experience is a little bit of, you know, about Alvin York and some of the problems that sometimes they say no prisoners. It almost sounds like Lawrence of Arabia saying no prisoners in the jungle. But that was rarely the case in World War One. It was the case in many cases, though, with the British, the Canadians, and the French. They had more, they were nastier to the Germans than we were. Now, with that said, once the Germans met the United States Marine Corps, that was when they became the Teufelhunde or the devil dogs. They had a lot of respect for them. They were, you know, but what can I say? You know, we didn't lose any. Most of the prisoners that were taken by the Germans survived. The Germans, there was a rule book in force. It was called the Hague Convention of 1899. The Germans obeyed the rules. We obeyed the rules. And there were times when the Canadians and the French and the Brits did not. But not so much the Americans. We weren't that mad. It takes a while to get mad at somebody. And that we were not that angry with them. And Pershing particularly respected the German soldiers because they acted like soldiers, behaved like soldiers. And that they were also pretty war-weary by 1918 as well. The next go-around for us is going to be World War II. World War II had to be the most law-abiding war when it comes to prisoners in the history of military history. It is truly bizarre. Now, with that said, we say, hey, Dr. Doyle, what about the Holocaust? The Holocaust is a separate item, and that it is directly related to Nazi ideology at its worst, at its most barbaric. And that, so I have to separate a discussion of the Holocaust with the discussion of military prisoners of war. Even at that, there was a hierarchy in the German world, and that on the top of the heap were pretty much the Americans and the British. They were equal opportunity prisoners there. And then under that, it's going to be the French and Belgians. Under that will be maybe the Poles, who they did not have a great deal of respect for. A lot of animosity there between the Germans and the Poles. But they did keep Polish prisoners. And then it keeps going down and down. The one thing the Germans did not do with either Americans, French, or British POWs was try to separate them in terms of religion. That is, it didn't matter if they were Jewish. If they were French, they were French. If they were British, I was reading the narrative of a British dentist who was captured in France in 1940. He was Jewish. The guy's name's Greenblatt. Any German would know that Greenblatt is Jewish, but they never bothered him. And all the way till 1945 and his liberation. He was British, you see. But their problem was with the Polish Jews and Russian Jews and Eastern Jews in general. And that, I just don't want to get into that. That's a whole separate story, and it's beyond the scope of what we're doing here. Anyway, the Germans obeyed the rules when it came to the Americans. The Americans obeyed the rules and created an environment for these Germans that was probably the best for 2 or 3 years of their entire life. I mean, it was paradise. We took the entire Africa Corps, whole thing. We had them all. The British said, could you take a few? And the Americans said, we can take them all. Because we had these little CCC camps, you know, the Civilian Conservation Corps that we had during the Depression. And then we made them into prisoner of war camps. They would take military installation, have a section be a prisoner of war camp. They had, you know, all kinds of places as prisoner of war camps. And what did they do? They harvested things like, they cut down trees in New Hampshire, raised watermelons in Hattiesburg, picked tomatoes, and they loved every minute of it. It was amazing. There were some Nazi camps, and that was a whole different story. The biggest problem the Germans had was killing each other. And once we figured out that the Nazi guys were really running these various camps, and they would pay a visit to their colleagues, maybe who spoke English, talked too much to the Americans, thought maybe they had ratted on them and things. And they called this the Holy Ghost. And so the Holy Ghost would visit you, you know, and with some very nasty weapons and would kill you. They killed about 14 guys. We tried, after the war, we actually brought to trial several German soldiers and sailors and found them guilty of murdering their own and executed them. They're buried out of Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, to this day. Germans don't want them back. Yeah, no, so they were murderers. I think we hanged 14 of them one night. Yeah, it was the second greatest mass execution in American history, the first one being the Santee War, right? And so, okay, with the Europeans, everybody obeyed the rules. And now with the Japanese, that was a whole different story. See, the Japanese did not sign Geneva 29. And the Russians did not sign Geneva 29 either. So they're outside the pale of the law. They did not feel they had any responsibility to their, you know, to their German prisoners. The Germans felt no responsibility for Russian prisoners. And when you have that situation, that leads to chaos. That's dangerous, and there's going to be a lot of people dying. And that's what happened. More Russians died as prisoners of the Germans than you can really, I can really even imagine. Millions died. Millions were MIA. And same thing in German prisoners in Russia. When Stalingrad fell, 80,000 prisoners are taken. 6,000 came home. Yeah. And all these, after all these big battles, the Russians took a lot of prisoners, starved them to death. Toward the end, though, in 45 and 46, here all these, the Russians decided to use these Germans to rebuild stuff that they had broken. So you wonder why the Russians have one of the finest metros in Moscow that of anywhere, because the Germans built it. These boys know how to work. And then when you worked for the Russians, they fed you. If you didn't work, you didn't eat. And so the Germans stayed as prisoners of war in the Soviet Union till 1954, when Konrad Adenauer, then the Chancellor of Germany, bought them out of prison. They came back in their Wehrmacht uniforms, the same uniforms that they were kept prisoner in. And that's how they came home. Yeah. With millions of MIAs to this day. Now, in dealing with the Japanese, they did not want to get captured. They killed themselves rather than be captured. So the idea here was, we'd try to get the it was very tough to keep the Marines from executing Japanese. It was really, really hard because they were angry. The war psychosis was up there. They knew the Japanese would do all sorts of weird things with hand grenades in their pockets and that kind of stuff, or try to kill themselves. But once the Japanese figured it out, they would rather live for the emperor than die for the emperor, the Japanese started to surrender. They were surrendering at Okinawa, even though you see them jumping over the, you know. But they were starting to surrender. A lot of the guys in the Japanese army who were not from Japan, like they're Formosans or Koreans, they didn't have this Bushido nonsense in their head, so they were starting to surrender some. But once we used the Japanese Americans to translate these documents into a kind of Japanese that the Japanese really did understand. In other words, they used the real language rather than some sort of heritage Japanese. And so the issue was live for the emperor. You know, live for the emperor. And that's your duty, is not to die for the emperor, but to live for the emperor. And once they started getting this message across, the Japanese started to surrender. We had about 3,000 Japanese, as opposed to many thousands of Germans, but we had 3,000 Japanese over that. In the United States, they were treated very well. Most of them, after they stopped trying to kill themselves, became very good prisoners. The first Japanese prisoner was taken to Pearl Harbor. And he was always known both for his rest of his life as prisoner number one. Yeah, and he made a sort of a bit of a conversion, helped the Americans with this leaflet to try to keep Japanese from killing themselves. We were very concerned. You know, an entire generation was wiping themselves out, not just by us shooting them as soldiers on these islands, but for them killing themselves. And they did this all the time. I mean, I could show you some really strange pictures my father took out in the South Seas. It's weird. It's very weird. Now, after World War II, you know, we had Nuremberg trials. I cover that in the book. There's trials in Tokyo. They're starting to get a little bit iffy. Never thought for one moment that the Koreans would come lemming-like over the Korean border on one nice June morning, June 25th of 1950, to be exact, and start another war. We weren't ready for that one. And that created a prisoner situation playing right into the hands of the North Koreans and the Chinese, and then had to suffer from really nasty uprisings in the prisoner of war camps. They wanted, you know, the issue was forced repatriation. We get into that in the other courses. And that one is a real mess. Vietnam, though, turned out pretty well vis-a-vis the POW situation. They had very few of ours, only about 600 and change. in North Vietnam. There were some, yes, in Laos, and there's some in Cambodia that just sort of went away, probably were killed. And we held several, many thousand of North Vietnamese and South Vietnamese Viet Cong in a prison system, about eight or nine prison camps. They did not want to do it at first, the South Vietnamese. They wanted to behave like Frenchmen. We wouldn't let them. And we created an ambiance that really did work, and it worked very well. It fell apart when the North Vietnamese overran the country. That's true. That was for a different reason, but the system worked very well. It was not something that we ever needed to be ashamed of, really, not at all. The prisoner of war situation in Vietnam was excellent as far as enemy prisoners of war were concerned. It was even better in the Gulf War. The Gulf War was nearly a perfect war. We held all the prisoners. We didn't hold them in Iran, or Iraq, rather. We held them in Saudi Arabia, and the Saudi Arabians actually did all the work. All we did was deliver them, and they were just surrendering. They were surrendering to helicopters. It was a conscript army that Saddam Hussein had. It was not a very good army. The Republican Guard we were a little afraid of, but we're going to deal with them later. Everybody knew that. The situation did fall apart with Iraq, unfortunately, and the Abu Ghraib thing. You had to check the book out for that. That's another complicated affair. That if there is an anomaly in our history, there are two anomalies. Civil War was one, and Iraq was the other anomaly, in the sense that the oversight there was horrendous, and they let people do things that they shouldn't have allowed them to do at levels that were terrible. You don't let sergeants run wild. You just don't do that. That's one blemish in our history that we have to live with. Secondly, we have Guantanamo Bay, and I'm very glad we have Guantanamo Bay. There's some pretty dangerous people down there now, and so we'll see how that works out. Opinions that are sort of out there on all of this. And so, anyway, I just want to finish up my part of all of this with a bit of a handout for you guys. You go ahead, Ned, see if you can get them out. And I'm going to use this when we show Andersonville Prison. And this one goes something like this. It goes, "Dear friends and fellow soldiers, bravo, listen to our song about the rebel prisons and our sojourn there so long. Yet our wretched state, oh great, no one can understand but those who have endured the fate in Dixie's sunny land. When captured by the cavalry, they'd strip us to the skin, but fail to give us back again the value of a pin. Except some lousy rags of gray discarded by their handband. This and thus commenced our prison life in Dixie's sunny land, with a host of guards surrounding us, each with a loaded gun. We were stationed in an open plain, exposed to rain and sun. No tent or tree to shelter us, we lay upon the sand. Thus side by side great numbers died in Dixie's sunny land. This was the daily bill of fare in that secesh saloon. No sugar, tea, or coffee there at morning, night, or noon. But a pint of meal, ground cob, and all was served to every man. For want of fire we ate it raw in Dixie's sunny land. We were by these poor rations soon reduced to skin and bone, a lingering starvation worse than death you can but own. There hundreds lay both day and night and day, by far too weak to stand, till death relieved their sufferings in Dixie's sunny land. We poor survivors oft were tried by many a threat and bribe to desert glorious Union cause and join that rebel tribe. Though fain were we to leave that place, we let them understand We'd rather die than thus disgrace our flag in Dixie's sunny land. Thus dreary days and nights roll by, yes, weeks and months untold. Until that happy time arrived, we were all paroled. We landed at Annapolis, a wretched-looking band, glad to be alive and free from Dixie's sunny land. How like a dream those days now seem in retrospective view, as we regain our wasted strength, all dressed in Union blue. The debt we owe our bitter foe shall not have long to stand. We shall pay it with a vengeance in Dixie's sunny land. Thank you. Okay, we're good. Now, this I'm going to make sure everybody gets the copy of this. This is taken from, this was sung by the Andersonville Survivors Association. That's where this comes from. These are all guys who were in there. So, and they meant it. And that we will see in class when I sing Good Old Rebel, which is the same tune, that they meant it too. So there's a, never goes away. Never goes away. Okay. Very good, my dear friends. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Can do. Oh, yes. Okay. Good, good. All righty. Now, it's either time to go to lunch or your next class. In Dixie's sunny land.
Next week on Lecture.